have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lot to share. We're going to start with the latest on health and healing. And one of the things I'm always concerned about is the amount of calories beyond what we need that we consume, and especially the source of those calories. More often than not, it's saturated fat and sugar. And sugar either is white sucrose or as high fructose corn syrup. They're both very bad for our health. This is just the latest study. This is from the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. And here's what it has to say. This was according to the National Cancer Institute. Too much sugar can set people down a pathway to heart failure. That is important. In fact, a single small molecule, the glucose metabolite glucose-6-phosphate, causes stress to the heart that changes the muscle proteins and induces poor pump function, leading to heart failure. That's according to the latest article published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. And it says that this G6P can accumulate from eating too much starch and sugar. Now, we know that heart failure kills about 5 million Americans every year, according to the Center for Disease Control. The one-year survival rate after diagnosis is 50%, and there's about 550,000 new patients in the United States diagnosed with heart failure every year. Quote, treatment is difficult. Physicians can give diuretics to control the fluid and beta blockers and ACE inhibitors to lower the stress on the heart and allow it to pump more economically. End quote. Now, according to the National Cancer Institute, sunlight-induced skin cancer is the most prevalent type of cancer in the United States, with more than 1 million cases each year. That's a lot. So how can we protect ourselves from that? Well, we can start by understanding not to be unprotected and make sure you're taking lots of antioxidants. And I mean a lot throughout the day. The more the antioxidants like vitamin C and quercetin that you take, the more the free radicals that enter the skin from the sunlight are grabbed, neutralized, and hence you're protected. So that's a separate issue. So you know to get rid of the sugar to protect your heart and use natural sweeteners like stevia. There's no calories. It's all natural. And if you want a natural sugar, then coconut sugar. It has a low glycemic index. And natural fructose that's not processed. So there are ways of getting a natural sweetener without it affecting our heart. There's a way of getting plenty of sunshine without making ourselves victims to skin cancer. Then for those of you who can't get a good night's sleep, the latest study is about valerian root. Now this was published in the Phytomedicine Journal, the peer-reviewed journal, and here's what it says. The valerian plant is an indigenous species native to Europe and Asia, but it's also been naturalized in America thanks to its now well-recognized tranquilizing, relaxing, and sedative properties, which are of great assistance when wanting to get rid of sleep problems. And what it does is this. When you take some valerian about 2 hours before you go to bed at night, it stabilizes the nervous system, and therefore that helps you with panic attacks, tension, stress, irritability, anxiety, even excitability and depression. And you don't have to take a high amount of it for it to work. It's been used to reduce symptoms of ADD and ADHD, and it's tranquilizing and calming, but it doesn't cause you any foggy or druggy effect. And it works. The scientific literature produced a lot of trials, which were conducted in order to verify if valerian was a valid treatment for insomnia. There are 9 separate clinical trials, and they show, yes, it is good. So valerian root, a natural substance that can help you in times of stress or when you're not getting a good night's sleep. We don't really see many Americans looking for exotic foods from other countries, but there is one that's delicious and very super packed with nutrition. It's called the Indian gooseberry. It is a superfood. It is very rich in natural antioxidants. And there was a study 2 years ago that the gooseberry contains a vast number of phenols, flavonoids, and tannins, as well as vitamin C. In fact, the average gooseberry contains 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C. That's 20 times more vitamin C than an orange. And like all antioxidants, it scavenges free radicals and protects you against cancer and a lot of other conditions. It also lowers your blood cholesterol. There was an article published in the Indian Journal of Clinical Biochemistry, and it showed that gooseberries can improve cardiovascular health by reducing blood cholesterol. And that's important, especially the bad LDL, in boosting the HDL, the good cholesterol. It improves gastrointestinal health. It's high in fiber. And the average berry is composed of about 80% water. And so it's a natural laxative. It really cleanses the gastrointestinal system. And the fiber in gooseberry binds with toxins, including toxins found in your colon, and hence helping protect you from colorectal cancer. And for diabetics, according to a study published in the Journal of Medicinal Foods, the Indian gooseberry can improve the glucose metabolism of diabetics and inhibit the production of glycosylated hemoglobin. That's hemoglobin molecules that have bound to glucose. And that's very beneficial for diabetics. So our food of the day, gooseberry. Our herb of the day, valerian root. Our message of the day, the sugar that you have been using can kill you and kills a lot of people. And, of course, the sun, we benefit from it, creates vitamin D, helps stimulate our immune system, but unprotected and too much leads to skin cancer, million new cases a year. Now, from our environmental segment today, there was a landslide vote for GMO labeling in Maine, and that's really exciting. It was 141-4. The Maine House of Representatives voted to advance Bill LD-718, which would require special labeling for seeds and foods made with genetically engineered ingredients. The Bangor Daily News reported that during the debate, there was little disagreement about the importance of GMO labeling. Quote, the consumers have a right to know, according to Representative Craig Hickman, and the people want to know what's in their food. And I say, good for all the people, from the Organic Seed Grower and Trade Association to Ronnie Cummins and all the activists, because it's really about the activists. It's all about the individuals at the grassroots level who wake up one day and decide, I'm going to make this a priority. I have to eat. We all have to eat. And if the average person is not aware of what they're eating, then they're going to be eating things that are not good for them. So we appreciate and we support the grassroots movement. And to help you come to an awareness of how bad GMOs are, I suggest that you watch Seeds of Death. Go to Gary Nall TV, just Gary Nall TV, or Gary Nall Facebook, and you'll find the film, the full film, and it's free. It's my gift to all the activists and all the people who want to know the truth about GMOs. Now, keep in mind, I intentionally held off finishing releasing the film till after the loss of, by on the part of us who wanted to see labeling of GMOs. And I wanted to see the arguments they used. I wanted to see how many lies they would tell. And once I saw what they had said to win over the population of California, we then started to deconstruct every one of their rationale. So anyone watching the film and anyone reading the article, which is always updated, every week we update it, you'll be able to then give a good argument to anyone in your own world about why this is an issue that's important. And also today, we've been hearing how in Japan, in fact from Japan Times, that the human papilloma vaccine is being challenged. Here's the latest from the Japan Times. The health ministry has issued a nationwide notice that cervical cancer vaccination should no longer be recommended for girls 12 to 16 because of several adverse reactions to the medicines have been reported. Quote, this is the chair of the panel on the Health, Labor, and Welfare Ministry. That would be similar to the head of the FDA. It is necessary to gather information immediately to accurately grasp how often the side effects are occurring. Now, the two vaccines sold in Japan are Cervarix, made by GlaxoSmithKline, of Britain, and Gardasil, made by Merck Sharp and Dohme, known as Merck. And so that is important because they're calling for the vaccine to be halted because they're seeing reactions. But in the United States, we've had over 130 deaths. We've had over 25,000 adverse reactions, the most of any vaccine. And yet, our FDA, our CDC, our U.S. Public Health Service, completely obedient to the pharmaceutical interest, are saying there's no problem. Well, there is. And on upcoming programs, we'll be talking with Dr. Diane Harper, who I filmed recently, and Cindy Bevington, the top journalist in America on the subject of the human papillomavirus vaccine, and 45 other women, scientists and physicians, about how everything about this is a fraud. And my recommendations, do your homework, because none of the statements they're making can they back up with actual science. That's the latest on health and nutrition, and there's one more issue I'm going to address, and this has to do with the public health issues. This is from Nation of Change, Adam Fetterman, and he's concerned about how corporations and law enforcement are spying on environmentalists. Now, when you consider how many environmentalists we have today, not just with Bill McKibben's group, but with all the other issues that are out there, anti-nuke, anti-hydrofracking, anti-GMOs, all of these are part of the environmental movement. You could even include in there the animal rights movement. It's also considered part of the environmental movement by the authorities. We're supposed to have a country that if we want to protest peacefully, protest something, you have a right to do so. You're protected by your First Amendment, your freedom of speech and assembly for that protest. But that's not how it works. And it's even worse under this president and his administration. Hard to imagine, but it's the facts. So now, peaceful protests, writing a letter, signing a petition, showing up for a demonstration, could put you on a list, including a potential terrorist list. Hard to imagine? It's true. Let me share this with you. I'm going to quote from Adam Fetterman from Nation of Change. In February 2010, Tom Junta and a small group of residents in northeastern Pennsylvania formed the Grass Drilling Awareness Coalition, an environmental organization opposed to hydraulic fracturing in the region. The group sought to appeal to the widest possible audience and was careful about striking a moderate tone. All members were asked to sign a code of conduct in which they pledged to carry themselves with professionalism, dignity, and kindness as they worked to protect the environment and their communities. The group founders acknowledged that gas drilling had become a divisive issue, misrepresented by individuals on both sides, and agreed to seek out the truth. The group of about 10 professionals, engineers, nurses, teachers, began meeting in the basement of a member's home. As their numbers grew, they moved to a local church. In an effort to raise public awareness about the risks of hydraulic fracturing or fracking, they attended township meetings, zoning and ordinance hearings, and gas drilling forums. They invited speakers from other states affected by gas drilling to talk with Pennsylvania residents. They held house party-style screenings of documentary films. Since the group had never engaged in any kind of illegal activity or particularly radical forms of protest, It came as a shock when the members learned that their organization had been featured in intelligence bulletins compiled by a private security firm, the Institute for Terrorism Research and Response. Equally shocking was the revelation that the Pennsylvania Department of Homeland Security had distributed those bulletins to local police chiefs, state and federal and private intelligence agencies, and the security directors of the natural gas companies, as well as industry groups and public relations firms. News of the surveillance broke in September 2010 when the director of the Pennsylvania Department of Homeland Security, James Powers, mistakenly sent an email to an anti-drilling activist he believed was sympathetic to the industry, warning her not to post the bulletins online. The activist was Virginia Cody, a retired Air Force officer. In his email to Cody, Powers wrote, quote, "We want to continue providing this support to the Marcellus Shell Formation natural gas stakeholders while not feeding those groups fomenting dissent against those same companies." The tri-weekly bulletins featured a wide range of supposed threats to the state's infrastructure, it including warnings about Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, pro-life activists, and Tea Party protesters. The bulletins also included information about when and where groups like the one that had been formed would be meeting, upcoming protests, and anti-fracking activists' internal strategies. The raw data was followed by a threat assessment, low, moderate, severe, critical, and a brief analysis. For example, Bulletin number 118, dated July 30, 2010, gave a low to moderate threat rating in reference to public meetings that anti-drilling activists plan to attend and suggest that an attack is likely and might well be executed, end quote. The threat assessment was accompanied by this note, quote, "The escalating conflict over natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania may define local fault lines and potentially increase area environmentalist activity or eco-terrorism. The communications of that one group cited northeastern Pennsylvania counties, specifically Wyoming, Lackawanna, and Luzerne, as being a real, quote, need of our help and facing a drastic situation," end quote. Another bulletin referenced an FBI investigation assessment of the growing threat of environmental activism to the energy industry. Because of Pennsylvania's importance in the production of natural gas, the researchers concluded an uptick in vandalism, criminal activity, and extremism was likely. Now, although the Pennsylvania scandal caused a brief public outcry, it was quickly brushed aside as an unfortunate mistake. In fact, the episode represents a large pattern of corporate and police spying on environmental activists, fueled in part by the expansion of private intelligence gathering since 9/11. In fact, the U.S. intelligence budget has been giving about 70% of it to private contractors, and much of that largesse has been directed towards overseas operations. But it's likely that a lot of that money also was paid to private contractors hired either by corporations or law enforcement agencies, and they're in the business of spying on American citizens. And so then anyone in these groups is then considered a potential terrorist, with all the information about that person turned over to all these different agencies. So then where are our freedoms, I have to ask? Where? Who's protecting our constitutional rights? Certainly not the corporate left or right. They're part of the problem. They're enabling the Department of Justice, they're enabling Homeland Security and these other myriad agencies to take tens of billions of dollars to spy on us. And that's the latest on that issue. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare.
Oh. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world who are listening in. We're going to take a few moments to focus on something I mentioned recently, that for a period of 4 weeks, that's all, of what will probably be about a two-year program, I wanted to see what kind of changes could occur in an individual who is diagnosed and treated for advanced Alzheimer's. and had been treated at a major Alzheimer's center at a major university in Manhattan, but was not getting good results. As a result, their daughter, named Vivian, the mother's also Vivian, reached out and said, "Is there anything that could help my mother?" And I said, "Well, it depends upon what she's willing to do and how far you're willing to go in order to get the best therapies possible." She said, "There's no limitation. I'm going to do everything I can for my mother." I said, "Fine. Now let's go over and see where we're at with Vivian." I have not spoken with Vivian's mother, nor with Vivian, on the progress that has been made in only 4 weeks. Keep in mind that this is going to take time. So any change at all in the first 4 weeks is important. Nice to have you with us, Vivian Sr. and Vivian Jr.
Thank you, Gary.
Let's begin with you, Vivian Jr. How long have you been helping your mom with her Alzheimer's?
I've been helping her for the past 2 years.
When your mother was being treated at a major teaching university by one of America's foremost Alzheimer's experts, what was the benefit of any or not of that therapy?
Well, there are only a certain number of drugs out there that they recommend for Alzheimer's, and my mother has been on the three main ones. She is currently taking a small dose of the Namenda. That's the only one that she is on. The others had negative adverse reactions.
Did you see any principal improvement in your mother in the years that she was using standard treatment for her Alzheimer's?
No. In fact, we saw no improvement. We saw decline, rapid decline.
What was the attitude of the physician towards your mother as therapy?
Very cold. Not helpful. And, I mean, my mother is 75, and, you know, she's just one of a million. And that this is the way it goes.
Bring us up to date. Tell us what that you can see that is a measurable, significant change.
We started your protocol 4 weeks ago, and it was amazing to me, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm being incredibly truthful. After the third day on the protocol, a behavior my mother was exhibiting called looping was...
Explain looping.
Looping is when short-term memory is one of the first things to go with Alzheimer's. And it's when you can't remember what you said 2 minutes ago or where you put something. And, oh, there you find the object or you remember it. And then 2 minutes later, you've lost the object again or you can't remember what you said. And a particular example, on day three of our protocol, my mother and I were together 24/7 for the first 2 weeks of the protocol. And in the morning, she would put on her watch, and then it would take about an hour before she would finally realize that her watch was on her wrist and not in the suitcase or in the dresser. And she would constantly search for her watch over and over again, to the point where, you know, I thought this is hopeless. But by day three, when we woke up, she didn't search for her watch. And I thought, this is odd. She didn't search for her watch from that point forward, or an object like that. By day seven, her short-term memory was again improved. It wasn't... She did have lapses, of course, but it wasn't as repetitive, and it wasn't as frequent. And by the end of 2 weeks, actually just after we came back from the 2 weeks at your ranch, now she was not in my care. My father was with her, and I was taking care of her on a daily basis but living out. He's keeping a journal, and he said, "Do you realize... your mother went from 8 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon with only two short-term lapses in her memory." I said, "No, you're kidding." He said, "No, And he said, I'm writing it down. And every day, it seems to be the time span between her memory is increasing. Other things are improving as well. She's juicing, doing the supplements, exercising vigorously, and getting sleep. When we started the protocol, she was sleeping a lot. During the day, she would take 3 naps, you know, at least an hour, hour and a half long. As of today, she can go without a nap, or maybe a 45-minute nap after her morning exercise. That's unusual. With Alzheimer's patients, they sleep a lot. Her memory is better. She now remembers when she lost something and she finds it. She doesn't leave her handbag. I can't believe the changes I'm seeing, the positive changes in her memory. Yes, she still has a way to go, but she was stage 5 Alzheimer's. That's moderate plus. And now she's exhibiting behaviors of someone who is, you know, maybe early stages of Alzheimer's.
It'll take about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted people to know that there are alternative approaches. And what else has changed? Exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Start with what she was able to do and now what she's able to do.
Well, she easily fatigued when we began the protocol. On the first day, we went for a walk, a quarter mile, and she was exhausted. You know, we went in the morning, it was nice and cool, but after a quarter mile, she said, oh, I can't do this, this is so hard. And I was like, Mom, you did great. How many laps did you do today? And she looked at it and she said, oh, it was 10. I was like, no, Mom, you did 1 lap on a quarter mile track, but that's very good. The next day, we doubled it, and then we began tripling it. And by the end of 2 weeks, Mother and I were doing 7 miles. Now, we started that a quarter mile 13 days earlier. By day 14, we actually did 7 miles. And it took us 3.5 hours because my mom has to constantly use the bathroom, so we'd have bathroom breaks. It's a consequence of Alzheimer's, and it's also a result of heavy juicing. But that's amazing. And now she's on protocol where she exercises, walks a minimum of 4 miles a day, and works out in the gym. We joined our local YMCA, and they're working with us. And we're also swimming. And all these are very, very positive. And she's actually lost 7 pounds and has more energy and more balance and coordination. 2 weeks ago in the swimming pool, one of the exercises was to walk, march along the black line in the pool, you know, just waist-high water. And Mother had difficulty doing that. But after maybe two or three times doing it in the pool, she can not only walk, march forward on the black line, she can go backwards and sideways. And she couldn't do that. Her balance and coordination is vastly improved. But the thing is, we found one day she didn't walk and she didn't swim and she didn't lift weights. And on that day, it was a Sunday, and my father said, the only difference that I can think of is the fact that she didn't exercise today. And so we're going to disagree with what you said about 6 days a week. I think it has to be 7 days a week of exercise of some sort, just to keep the blood going to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. And my father and mother agree, because you know what? She feels so much better with the exercise.
What does your father say are the major improvements he's observed?
He's observed her memory's coming back. Now, she's also under the dementia umbrella, and she is exhibiting signs of, you know, quick recall, and he's surprised. He also said she's when she walks, he watches her. He can't walk physically as much as she does because of his health, but when he, his legs. But when he sees her walking around the track, he said, I've never seen anything like it.
Vivian Senior, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's nice to be here, literally.
What have you seen that's different? What can you give us of your own personal observation?
Well, I'm listening to what my daughter says and my father and my husband says, and I am able to do all of the things that she just told you, and I enjoy doing it, and it's nothing that I am saying, oh, I don't want to do that. I just can't wait to get out there, and I, on the track, which I do, and I do the 2 miles today, I enjoy everything I'm doing, the pool, the this, the that, the food is so delicious that the shakes are so delicious. That's one thing. And they are so good that you know that they're helping you the minute you swallow one. So it's food, it's exercise, it's being happy and healthy and getting out there and doing it. Really, I am so happy. And the kids are saying, this is great, Mom, you're doing this, you're doing that. And I don't know where I stepped off and fell into the water, but I'm out of the water now and I'm doing my best. And I hope that I can stay that way. And thank you.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
All the best to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Vivian and Vivian, daughter and mother. That's after 4 weeks. Now we'll see what happens after the next 6 months. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Now we'll hear from Chris Hedges in discussion with Jeffrey Stone on Edward Snowden.
We turn now to a debate on Edward Snowden's decision to leak a trove of secret documents outlining the NSA's surveillance program. Edward Snowden's actions have elicited a range of reactions. Jeffrey Toobin of CNN and The New Yorker writes that Snowden is, quote, a grandiose narcissist who deserves to be in prison. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said that Snowden should not be considered a whistleblower because, quote, what he did was an act of treason. And Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina tweeted, I hope we follow Mr. Snowden to the ends of the earth to bring him to justice, language echoing what Senator Graham once said in the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
Meanwhile, Douglas Rushkoff wrote on CNN, quote, Snowden's a hero because he realized our very humanity was being compromised by the blind implementation of machines in the name of making us safe, unquote. The editor of the American Conservative, Scott McConnell, wrote, quote, if Obama wanted to do something smart, he should thank Snowden and offer him a job as a White House technology advisor. And Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg sang Snowden's praises, writing, quote, quote, in my estimation, there has not been in American history a more important leak than Edward Snowden's release of NSA material, and that definitely includes the Pentagon Papers 40 years ago. For more, we host a debate on Edward Snowden. Is he a hero or a criminal, whistleblower or traitor? Here in New York, we're joined by Chris Hedges, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 15 years, was part of a team of reporters that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for the paper's coverage of global terrorism, author along with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of the New York Times bestseller Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. His most recent article is called The Judicial Lynching of Bradley Manning at truthdig.org. And in Chicago, Illinois, we're joined by Jeffrey Stone, a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. His recent piece for the Huffington Post is called Edward Snowden, Hero or Traitor. Stone served as an informal advisor to President Obama in 2008. In 1992, 20 years ago, Professor Stone hired Obama to teach constitutional law at the University of Chicago. Jeffrey Stone is also author of many books, including Top Secret, When Our Government Keeps Us in the Dark, and Perilous Times, Free Speech and Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. Chris Hedges, Jeffrey Stone, we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Stone, I want to begin with you. In your piece, you say that Edward Snowden's actions were criminal. Can you explain why you feel he should be in jail?
Well, there is a federal statute that makes it a crime for public employees who have been granted access to classified information to reveal that information to persons who are unauthorized to receive it. So from a simple, straightforward, technical legal standpoint, there's absolutely no question that Snowden violated the law. And from that standpoint, if he's tried, he will be convicted, and he is, in fact, from that perspective, a criminal. Whether one admires what he did is another question, but it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not what he did was unlawful. The question of why I think he deserves punishment is he said it actually himself in the clip that you played earlier. He said, I'm just an ordinary guy. Well, the fact is, he's just an ordinary guy with absolutely no expertise in public policy, in the law, in national security. He's a techie. He made the decision on his own without any authorization, without any approval by the American people to reveal classified information about which he had absolutely no expertise in terms of the danger to the nation, the value of the information to national security. That was a completely irresponsible and dangerous thing to do. Whether we think it was a positive thing in the long run or not, it's a separate question, but it was clearly criminal.
Chris Hedges, your response.
Well, what we're really having a debate about is whether or not we're going to have a free press left or not. If there are no Snowdens, if there are no Mannings, if there are no Assanges, there will be no free press. And if the press, and let's not forget that Snowden gave this to The Guardian. This was filtered through a press organization in a classic sort of way whistleblowers provide public information about unconstitutional criminal activity by their government to the public. So the notion that he's just some individual standing up and releasing stuff over the internet is false. But more importantly, what he has exposed essentially shows that anybody who reaches out to the press to expose fraud, crimes, unconstitutional activity, which this clearly appears to be, can be traced and shut down. And that's what's so frightening. So we are at a situation now, and I speak as a former investigative reporter for the New York Times, by which any investigation into the inner workings of government has become impossible. That's the real debate.
Well, Chris, how do you respond to the point that Jeffrey Stone made and how Snowden identified himself as an ordinary guy? Should any regular government employee or contractor be allowed to disclose whatever information he feels the public ought to be privy to, whether it's classified by the government and his employer or her employer or not?
Well, if that is what an act of conscience is, and reporters live, our sort of daily fare is built, investigative reporters, off of people who, within systems of power, have a conscience to expose activities by the power elite which are criminal in origin or unconstitutional, and that's precisely what he did. And he did it in the traditional way, which was going to a journalist, Glenn Greenwald, and The Guardian, and having it vetted by that publication before it was put out to the public. Was it a criminal? Well, yes, but it was, I suppose, in a technical sense, it was criminal, but set against the larger crime that is being committed by the state. When you have a system by which criminals are in power, criminals on Wall Street, who are able to carry out massive fraud with no kinds of repercussions or serious regulation or investigation, criminals who torture in our black sites, criminals who carry out targeted assassinations, criminals who lie to the American public to prosecute preemptive war, which under international law is illegal. If you are a strict legalist, as apparently Professor Stone is, what you're in essence doing is protecting criminal activity. I would argue that in large sections of our government, it's the criminals who are in power.
Professor Stone, your response.
Well, first of all, there is, so far as I can tell from everything that's been revealed, absolutely nothing illegal or criminal about these programs. They may be terrible public policy, and I'm not sure I approve of them at all, but the fact is the claim that they're unconstitutional and illegal is wildly premature. Certainly, from the standpoint of what's been released so far, whether Mr. Hedges likes it or not, or whether Mr. Snowden likes it or not, these are not unconstitutional or illegal programs.
Let me go to a letter that you co-signed, Professor Stone, in 2000. 2006 with other prominent attorneys about NSA surveillance under President Bush. You were criticizing it. You wrote, quote, "Although the program's secrecy prevents us from being privy to all of its details, the Justice Department's defense of what it concedes was secret and warrantless electronic surveillance of persons within the United States fails to identify any plausible legal authority for such surveillance. Accordingly, the program appears on its face to violate existing law." How do you compare that to what we're seeing today?
They're two completely different programs. The Bush NSA surveillance program was enacted in direct defiance of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The Obama program, if we want to call it that, was approved by Congress. That's number one. Number two is the Bush program involved wiretapping of the contents of phone conversations. The Supreme Court has long held that that is a violation of the Fourth Amendment if there's not an individualized determination of probable cause. The Obama program, if we want to call it that, does not involve wiretapping. It involves phone numbers. And the Supreme Court has long held that the government is allowed to obtain phone records, bank records, library records, purchase records, once you disclose that information to a third party. And there is no Fourth Amendment violation. So they're two completely different programs.
But if you just heard our conversation with the mathematician Susan Lando, she argued that often metadata is more revealing than the transcript of an actual conversation. Do you think the law should change, Jeffrey Stone, to include this metadata?
Well, I'm not persuaded by her argument that it's more revealing. I do believe that it's problematic, and I think in fact there should be statutes that prohibit the gathering of this type of data by private entities as well as by the government in the absence of at least a compelling justification. And I thought the Supreme Court's decisions initially on this question were wrong, so I would certainly want to see them differently. But in terms of what the law is, it's not unconstitutional, it's not illegal, and it's completely different from what the Bush administration was doing.
Chris Hedges, do you agree that...
Well, there are plenty of lawyers who disagree with Professor Stone.
Not many.
Well, the ACLU has just issued a lawsuit over this, claiming that it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So I haven't done a poll. Frankly, the legal profession under this steady assault of civil liberties can't hold its head very high. There are a few out there at the ACLU, Michael Ratner and a few others. But, you know...
Stone, aren't you on the board of the ACLU, or were you?
I'm on the National Advisory Council.
Yes. So what do you think of them suing the government over this?
I think it's great. I think that, they are perfectly right to bring the question. That's their job. Their job is to challenge whether or not things are constitutional, to raise those questions. That's exactly what they should be doing. Doesn't mean they're always right, but they should be presenting these questions to the courts. That's their job. That's their responsibility.
Chris Hedges, one of the problems that people have pointed to is that there aren't procedures or mechanisms in place for people within the government to point out wrongdoing when it does occur. Do you think that's one of the problems that's occurred in this case with Edward Snowden, or for that matter, your most recent article was on Army whistleblower Private Bradley Manning?
Well, we used to have a mechanism. It was called the press. And we used to be able to tell our sources that they would be protected. That they would not be investigated for providing information that exposed the inner workings of power. Unfortunately, the press, like most institutions in this country, and I would add the legal profession, has largely collapsed under this corporate coup d'etat that's taken place and is no longer functioning. And I want to get back that what this is fundamentally a debate about is whether we are going to have, through the press, an independent institution within this country that can examine the inner workings of power or not. And it is now, I mean, many of us had suspected this widespread surveillance, but now that it's confirmed, we're seeing, you know, why did Snowden come out publicly? Well, because I think he knew that they would find out anyway, because they have all of Glenn Greenwald's email, phone records, and everything else. And they can very quickly find out who he was speaking to and whether Snowden had contact with him. And that, you know, I speak as a reporter, is terrifying because it essentially shuts down any ability to counter the official propaganda and the official narrative and expose the crimes. And we have seen in the last few years tremendous crimes being committed by those in power.
power, we have no ability now to investigate them.
Professor Stone, let me ask you about whether the reporters from The Guardian and The Washington Post should be prosecuted. CNN's Anderson Cooper put this question to Republican Congressmember Peter King of New York last night.
As far as reporters who help reveal these programs, do you believe something should happen to them? Do you believe they should be punished as well?
Actually, if they willingly knew that this was classified information, I think action should be taken, especially on something of this magnitude. I know that the whole issue of leaks has been gone into over the last month, but I think something on this magnitude, there is an obligation, both moral but also legal, I believe, against a reporter disclosing something which would so severely compromise national security.
Professor Stone, your response to what Peter King is saying?
He's just wrong. The Supreme Court in the Pentagon Papers case, for example, made very clear that Daniel Ellsberg could be prosecuted as a public official, stealing information that the New York Times and the Washington Post could not be restrained from publishing that information. The court has essentially held that although the government can control classified information at its source by prohibiting employees from revealing it, once the information goes out, it cannot then punish the press for publishing it. It's a little bit odd as a system, but the idea is that on the one hand we have freedom of the press, which has to be preserved. On the other hand, the government has a legitimate interest in maintaining confidentiality at the source within the government itself. So no, clearly Grunwald and Reuters and so on, none of those can be The Guardian, none of those can be punished consistent with the First Amendment. That's clear.
Professor Stone, so do you believe that Edward Snowden's position is comparable to Daniel Ellsberg's position with the Pentagon Papers, and that The Guardian played a comparable role to The New York Times?
So I think Snowden's position, based upon what I know now, is much worse. Ellsberg revealed historical information that had really no appreciable threat to the national security. It was all old information about what the government had done in the past. What Snowden has revealed is information about ongoing programs, which we're told are extremely important to the national security, and we're told that the revelation of those programs makes them far less efficient. That's a very serious, potentially very serious harm to the nation. That was not the case in Ellsberg's situation.
Well, Professor Stone,
so I think from that standpoint,
Henry Kissinger said Dan Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America. So they certainly, at that time, they were telling us that what he was doing was threatening national security.
He said that at the time before they had an opportunity to really reflect on what was released. Years later, or even weeks later, that was no longer the case. So I think that those two situations are not remotely comparable in terms of the harm that Ellsberg did to the country, which I think was trivial, relative to what Snowden has done, which arguably is far more serious. Let me make another point about civil liberties here, by the way. It's extremely important to understand that if you want to protect civil liberties in this country, you not only have to protect civil liberties, you also have to protect against terrorism. Because what will destroy civil liberties in this country more effectively than anything else is another 9/11 attack. And if the government is not careful about that, and if we have more attacks like that, you can be sure that the kind of things the government's doing now are going to be regarded as small potatoes compared to what would happen in the future. So it's very complicated asking what's the best way to protect civil liberties in the United States.
I just don't buy this argument that, you know, this hurts national security. I covered al-Qaeda for the New York Times, and believe me, they know they're being monitored. The whole idea that somehow it comes as a great surprise to jihadist groups that their emails, websites, and phone calls are being tracked is absurd. We're talking about the wholesale collection of information on virtually most of the American public. And the consequences of that are truly terrifying. At that point, we are, in essence, snuffing out the capacity of any kind of investigation into the inner workings of power. And to throw out this notion that this harmed national security, there's no evidence for that, in the same way that there is no evidence that the information that Bradley Manning leaked in any way harmed national security. It didn't. What the security and surveillance state is doing is playing on fear and using that fear to accrue to themselves tremendous forms of power that in a civil society, in a democracy, they should never have. And that's the battle that's underway right now, and frankly, we're losing.
I wanted to ask you, Professor Stone, to reflect on Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail written April 16, 1963, when he said, "One who breaks an unjust law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for law." Could you respond to that?
Well, obviously, King... Sure, obviously King is right. The question is whether it's an unjust law. So people who violate a law because they think it is unjust don't necessarily fit within the letter from the Birmingham jail. King was talking about protesting racial segregation, and that's a little bit different in terms of the moral status of it. Now, maybe it's true. I mean, maybe Chris Hedges is right, and maybe that that Snowden is a hero, and maybe this is all a fraud on the part of the government. This information serves no useful purpose, and it's fundamentally important to the United States that it's been revealed. Maybe that's true, and if it turns out to be true, then I'll be the first to say Snowden was a hero. But at the moment, I have absolutely no reason to believe that. And to say that some people act on legitimate conscience and therefore violate unjust laws is not to say that everyone who violates a law is Martin Luther King in the Birmingham jail.
I want to put that question to Chris, but I wanted to ask you, Jeffrey Stone, if you were Edward Snowden's attorney, what arguments would you put forward for him right now?
Legally, I don't think he has, honestly, I don't think he has any legal arguments that would be a defense to the charge that he violated the law about government contractors not disclosing classified information to persons who are not authorized to receive it. I don't think he has a defense. Some people commit a crime, and they committed the crime. And I don't know that there's any defense sometimes.
Interestingly, Dan Ellsberg faced treason trial, but ultimately he ended up being exonerated because of the illegal wiretapping that was done of him.
Well, he wasn't exonerated. In his case, the judge dropped the charges against him because the Nixon administration searched his psychiatrist's office in violation of the Constitution, and the judge concluded that that was prosecutorial misconduct and therefore dismissed the prosecution. If the government does something similar in Snowden's case and the court finds that it's a violation of its constitutional rights in the course of the investigation and dismisses the charges, that would be something, as his lawyer, I'd certainly want to know. But on the merits of the charge as it presently stands, I think it's a sentencing question, not a criminality question.
Chris Hedges, if you could respond to the King quote and the significance of what Snowden did.
Well, without figures like Snowden, without figures like Manning, without figures like Julian Assange, essentially the blinds are drawn. We have no window into what's being done in our name, including the crimes that are being done in our name. Again, having worked as an investigative reporter, the lifeblood of my work were figures like these who had the moral courage to stand up and name the crimes that they witnessed. And these people are always at the moment that they stand up. And even King, of course, was persecuted and reviled and denounced, hounded by J. Edgar Hoover, who attempted through blackmail to get him to commit suicide before accepting the Nobel Prize. Let's not forget that all of these figures, like Snowden, come under this character assassination, which, frankly, I think Professor Stone is engaging in. And that's not uncommon. That's what comes with the territory when you carry out an act of conscience. It's a very lonely and frightening, and it makes these figures, like Snowden, deeply courageous, because the whole debate, traitor or whistleblower, for me, hearing this on the press is watching the press commit collective suicide, because without those figures, there is no press.
I wanted to end with Professor Stone. You were an early advisor to President Obama. You gave him his first job at University of Chicago Law School. You were the dean of the University of Chicago Law School. What would you advise him today?
I think there needs to be a really careful reevaluation of the classification system. There's no question that we wildly overclassify, and that creates all sorts of problems, for both for the press and for the ability of the government to keep secrets, because if you try to keep everything secret, you don't effectively keep very much secret. So I think that's critical. I think there is a serious question about how we make the trade-off between security and privacy, and I think that that's an issue that needs to be addressed carefully, certainly within the administration, within the government, to the extent there are genuinely secret policies that need to be kept secret, and I believe that perfectly possible, then I think that does not immunize them from serious debate by responsible people within the four corners of the administration, bringing in people who can have national security clearances to take the devil's advocate position and challenge these issues. So I think there's a lot that can and should be done, and I think that it's easy to get swept up in the notion of security being the be-all and end-all. This is a nation that's committed to individual privacy, to freedom of the press, to freedom of speech, and those values need to be respected. And I think government constantly has to be re-examining itself because all the temptations are in the wrong direction.
Professor Jeffrey Stone, before we conclude, I'd like to ask you about an article you wrote in 2011 for the New York Times called Our Untransparent President. You wrote, quote, "The record of the Obama administration on this fundamental issue of American democracy has surely fallen short of expectations. This is a lesson in trust us. Those in power are always certain that they themselves will act reasonably, and they resist limits on their own discretion. The problem is, trust us is no way to run a self-governing society." End quote. What's your assessment of the comments that you made then relative to now and Obama's record on transparency and civil liberties?
I think the comment was correct then, and I think it's correct today. I think that there's a temptation on the part of public officials to basically say, we don't want to be hassled, we don't want to be bothered, we don't want to be criticized, so we'll just do what's in the best interest of the country, and we don't have to tell anybody about it. And that's a huge danger in a democracy. But the fact that I accept that and passionately believe it does not mean that everything the government does in confidence and in secret should not be in confidence or in secret. The problem was where to draw the line. So yes, I would criticize the Obama administration in general for being overly concerned with secrecy and not being sufficiently transparent. The point I made earlier about overclassification is a good example. But at the same time, I do recognize that there are situations in which secrecy is critical, and the problem is being able to discern when that's necessary and when it's not. And to do that, you need to have people within the debate who are internally challenging the necessity for secrecy and confidentiality. I don't think the Obama administration has done a very good job of that.
Chris Hedges, just 30 seconds, and I know that you were attending the Bradley Manning trial, but linking the two.
Well, we're talking about the death of a free press, the death of a civil society. This is far beyond a reasonable debate. We make the East German Stasi state look like the Boy Scouts. And if we don't wrest back this power for privacy, for the capacity to investigate what our power elite is doing, I think we can essentially say our democracy has been snuffed out.
Chris Hedges and Jeffrey Stone, I want to thank you for being with us. Jeffrey Stone, former dean at the University of Chicago Law School, now professor there. His recent piece for the Huffington Post is called Edward Snowden, Hero or Traitor. Chris Hedges, longtime journalist, now senior fellow at the Nation Institute, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, before that for 15 years, part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on the next program.